were to move around the literal world of shamanic tradition, the essence would become more and more obvious as the actual physical practices of each tradition would fade away. Bradford Keeney, PhD, has actually made that journey and was incredibly recognized by each culture to hold the mojo, that medicine that is woven behind, in front of, and throughout the visual scenes we experience in our lives. Today we'll talk about one of his books, The Bushman Way of Tracking God. There's a lot I could say about Brad, but in keeping with the theme, experience beats words every time. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Brad, before we let your book, The Bushman Way of Tracking God, lead us into our discussion, briefly share your introduction to the Kalahari Bushmen.
Well, the Kalahari Bushmen are the oldest living elders, the oldest living tradition, culture on Earth. And we know this because of science. Geneticists have traced those who are closest to Adam and Eve as being in southern Africa. And we find them in the Kalahari Bushmen. And I was once a visiting professor at the University of South Africa. And when I was given that invitation to teach there, I asked if I could go visit them. And this was all led about because I'd had an interesting dream that was literally a map of where this particular band of Bushmen were living. So it was my great opportunity to meet them and establish relationships and have them become a second family, to learn about their way of being in the world and how they foster good feelings in one another without having to get stuck into the kind of traps we get stuck into, which involve endless narratives and explanations and theorizing as to what's going on inside our personalities and all of that nonsense. In fact, they would say we're basically mad as a hatter. Whenever they feel, you know, some irritation or discouragement or in need of rejuvenation or tuning, they gather together and bring out the musicians and clap their hands and have a dance that sends them to the heavens, unassisted by any plants or medicines or sacred literature or meanings. They just go straight to the source, unfiltered by anything. And it changed my life, and it made me feel how strange the world we live in when we turn to best-selling authors and noted spiritual teachers, whom the Bushmen, who've been doing this for over 100,000 years, perhaps, in terms of their healing tradition, would regard those teachers we regard as important as completely mad. So that's how I'd like to begin. So we can go anywhere from there.
Okay. Well, after reading your book, I would definitely agree that they're onto something by the fact that they don't see anyone as spiritually enlightened, that every person is equally ignorant and out of whack.
That's right. And if you are, it's not going to last. You know, it's a momentary thing. Same that nobody's really a shaman or nobody's a healer. However, though, we can learn to step into a particular context, a moment when we can be seized by the life force, by something bigger than us, and then perform as an extended arm, if you wish, as the voice of something that's greater than us. But it's only momentary. You know, when the ceremony's over, the next day when we wake up, we're complete morons all over again.
Right. I love how they feel words are for teasing. And that obviously leads down that road to not being able to take ourselves too seriously, being continually knocked off our rocker. What did they tease you about when you first started hanging out with them?
Oh, there isn't anything that's not teased. You know, whatever you would hold as sacred, important, they're going to tease you. And if you have skill and natural talent at something, you'll be teased. And there's no end to it, you know, in terms of their own communities. If a hunter comes home with, you know, a successful catch, people, you know, will tease them, saying you must have sung a mating song to have attracted the animal, and they go much further than that. But it's this kind of leveling the ground, and yet behind it is something more than a relaxation of tensions or a massaging of any rigid hierarchy. Behind it is a great wisdom I think we've missed, because it's hard for us to realize that there's a way of living that's not principally organized by language, by knowing, by epistemology, by theories, by understanding. And we think it's the whole show. We think we just have to have the right understanding, the right philosophy, the right theology, the right spirituality. And if we understand correctly or wisely, then we'll know how to act. Where in fact, it's just the opposite. Do anything. Act first in order to know. Know what? Order to know how to change yourself to act differently in the next round. In other words, the Kalahari Bushmen are teaching us to live life as jazz, to see that the key metaphor is improvisation, not knowing. And I don't mean not knowing as a concept that's been reified in our culture as a kind of specialized knowing.
Right. That not knowing is like, hey, the Westerners certainly have that one down. It's an important point that in the fact that they use words for teasing, the words are not trusted to hold the most important wisdom. It's certainly known that it's the experience.
That's right. We somehow know this too, but we just keep losing track. We think that we are the story, some story, but we forget, of course, that our story changes given the audience that we're with, or the friends, or the whatever we happen to have for breakfast. We're parts of stories. We're strands that are constantly mutating, changing. And they're not necessarily congruent. I mean, we are all contradictions, living contradictions, and we should celebrate that rather than pretending that we live inside of a simplistic narrative form that says, in the beginning I did this, then this happened to me, and hence this is why I am now and will probably become that. I mean, this is not in the moment. In the moment means no story. It means no story holds past, you know, a beginning, a middle, and an end. We're just here now being improvised by the present interactions that organize us. In other words, you know, they would say that we should start worshiping play rather than being so damn serious about everything. I sound serious, don't I? I should lighten up.
Well, I want to ask you to move into their story about first creation and how the trickster is an important part of their story. And I don't know if it's okay, but to also call their story their mythology. But I was just in the preparation of doing this interview, this whole story just started forming in me about imagining, as the evolution of the Kalahari were happening, every once in a while a serious philosophical being would be born among them, and then it would just feel like the trickster would be put there right in front of him to totally knock them sideways and get them off of that philosophical bent.
Well, it's interesting to muse on their story of the origin of human beings and how we've, you know, come about, because this is the oldest living culture, and so what they would say certainly should be of interest to us. And keep in mind that, you know, anthropologists have studied the Bushmen left and right, you know, for many years, perhaps the most studied, they and the Diné or Navajo of all cultures. But in spite of that, they've really been sort of lost as to how the Bushmen make sense of the world. Because every time they ask them a question, it's likely to change. Their answer is likely to change. And so, you know, there was posed this view that they were inconsistent or didn't have a formal philosophic way of holding things together. But it missed a very more important, deeper point, that they were improvising and always moved by the particularities of the situation. So their beginning story, the very first story, one might say, is that they say in the beginning was first creation. And in first creation, everything changed into everything. So I could be looking at you, and you change into a giraffe, while I change into a lion. But then we could do all kinds of cross-changing. You might look down at your feet and see that of an eland. But look at your head, and now it's a hippopotamus. And now our hands change, and the other part changes, and round we go, inside, outside. We're becoming each and everything. And because of the constant changing, there's always health. There's always joy and ecstatic delight. And there's no death. everything changes. Everything communicates. We can talk to the giraffes because the giraffes can be us in any moment. We can talk to the lions. We can talk to everything that lives, plants, trees, all of it living, changing. It's a world of constant shape-shifting. Then second creation arose. Second creation was the naming. Things were given a name. We named this a zebra. Then the zebra stopped changing. It stood still. We became human beings. We became a man. We became a woman. We stopped changing. And the cost of stopped changing was that we then developed symptoms and sickness, and we passed away. But of course, this is only part of the story. Because if you think about it, it now becomes a very fascinating and complex return of the circle. If everything's changing, then everything that's changing must itself change. So the change of changing would be to not change. So that the changing that stops is a change of a higher order. And this is a kind of Ouroboros, where the circle swallows itself and gives rise to something that's really not separate, not distinct, not a dualism, but it's something that's held within first creation. So language, naming, all our theories, all our ways of stopping the world, echo of Carlos Castaneda, yes, all the ways of stopping the world are themselves products, creations of movement inside of first creation. Knowing this means that a traditional healer or a shaman or someone who feels moved to move, and I mean fully embodied movement, so you're not just thinking about it as a concept, you just feel it inside of yourself, you just feel your voice start to change, you just feel something coming on you, and you get so enthusiastic that you want to wiggle, you want to shake, you want to dance, you want to be danced, all of a sudden you're inside the changing. And this is what the shamans do. They open their hearts so they feel so fully that they're able to step inside of first creation. And inside of first creation, they feel themselves change into all possibilities. And there, with one foot inside of first creation, another foot inside of second creation, they're at the twilight, not one, not the other, but in between, going back and forth. And that is the shaking, and that is the changing, and that's where the things that need to be healed can be brought and transformed in all kinds of beautiful and creative ways.
Well, I certainly see how the naming of something creates the stagnation. And I'm wondering how, I mean, obviously if you went there and started doing an Ashtanga 2-hour routine or a Qigong or Tai Chi movement routine, I'm sure they would have something to say about that. And yet it seems to work for people. So what do you have to say about that?
Everything works. Everything self-verifies. And that's just the interesting thing about human experience. You can drink a glass of water and it can heal you. If the appropriate beliefs and relational contingencies are put in play. The difference is that what arises as a form is in the moment a truth born of that moment and having an integrity and authenticity that is filled with the life force, or as the Bushmen say, boom. That's very different than when the form is frozen, whether it's photographed or whether it's memorized in the body or whether it's written down in a text. Then it's taught as the form you need to master. Now you can perform that form, but it's going to be rather lifeless unless one day the form spontaneously arises. This is the trap of playing classical music. You go to the conservatory, and how few people go through it at the end and are able to sit down and play it as if it were played for the first time. We're talking about that special quality of having music rather than being just technical perfection. The same with choreographed dance, with choreographed Qigong. All these matters, they're upside down.
Right.
The oldest way is that you allow the movements to rise spontaneously, because that's how they were born in the first place. Someone just didn't sit down and say, let's go to the original library left by Martians, and there's a guide to all these forms of body posture, and if you step into them and wait patiently after practicing, one day they awaken. Instead, they jumped off the cliff and let life grab hold of them, and then a movement came forth that it looks like, oh, I know that movement because I've seen, I was taught that in this class or that class. That's a very different kind of way. So what they point to us is the origins of how things are created, and they're created inside improvisation. Their own rules, their own forms, their own ideas take place for a moment, but then need to be let go of and not be one attached to it. But everything from east and west, in this sense, the east and west are the same. We're all saying you have to go memorize the forms and practice, practice, practice. There is no practice in the Kalahari. And for the greatest artist, there's never a practice, because all practice teaches is how to look like you're practicing. You want to be performing the concert. You want to be the music. You don't want to be practicing, get the scales down, get all the moves down, stack it all together, and someday you make music. You short-circuit it. I don't want to sound like I'm practicing the piano. I'm going to be making, I want music to be coming through me. So these are just ideas that come about when we ask the kind of question you did.
Yes. I'm curious about the title, Tracking God. I know the Kalahari are amazing trackers, but I think they feel God is everywhere. So why the need to track God?
It's both. See, they won't put anything in the duality. It's like Trickster. A trickster would be associated with the changing forms of second creation. Trickster is the use of language. It's how it teases our mind to just invent whatever it wants to invent at the moment. Hence, look at any sacred text, hermeneutics, anyone that interprets a sacred text, you know, as we all know, organizes its meaning to be that which serves our own desires at the moment. For them, trickster and the holy are not a dualism. Again, second creation is inside of first creation. But there's this doubleness, this more than both and-ness, not either or and not both and, but something that is arising in the movement of relationship that is difficult to specify, but a complexity that we see in, let's just introduce the science of cybernetics, which is going to sound strange, but we also see in higher order expression of in the arts, such as poetics, which is all about these circularities. So God has the form of trickster, which is present everywhere. But then the non-changing God, the God of creation, can be realized as up in the sky village, in which a rope is dropped from the sky, and you walk toward it, and up you go to visit and dance with the ancestors. But, of course, that realization of the rope is just a kind of psychosynesthetic realization of relationship. And relationship implies, you know, the difference in order to enter it. So on and on our words can circle and try to say, yes, God is everywhere, but no, God is up in the sky, and no, God is below, and just keep the conversation moving so we don't rest settled in any particular utterance. So it's yes and no to everything. And since it confuses us, let's just laugh, tease each other, and say, aren't we silly that we try to figure things out are so way beyond.
I know.
To hold. It's also silly.
I know. I love that. Yeah, I love that. When I got to a point where I just felt like I could totally let go of cause and effect, I mean, it gets so tiring.
right. I mean,
and being silly. Able to let that go is so freeing, and it's just like, not, first of all, it doesn't matter the cause and effect, nor could we ever possibly have all of the factors in order to make a really intelligent.
Exactly. It's just why when you look at New Age, as opposed to whatever it claims not to be new, it's the same causality. I mean, people are hawking, if you take this supplement, then you get this benefit. If you eat bacon, you will get sick. This is like crazy. You know, let's celebrate. Let's have Bacon Day just to free people from causality. There just isn't, and there's nothing worse. I mean, both complementary medicine and medicine are the same. They're declaring that this thing, you know, causes, or this ensemble of things leads to the likelihood of your being in a state of health, and these things don't. There's no complexity in that, and it's the same. And so I see no difference between hardcore pharmacological medicine, and Andy Weil's pills, that are vitamins. It's the same causality. It's the same reductionism. It's the same trap. And it's not about maximizing some things in the world, saying these are the good things, and minimizing the others. This fractionates the complexity of all the relations in an ecosystem.
Yes, and it just uses up all that energy once again, moving back and forth and back and forth and back and forth.
Exactly. Some of the saints and mystics supposedly were able to survive just on a tasty meal of air. So if that's so, then so would a Mars bar. You're going to find, I'm sure someone that's in a highly energized state and well-tuned can find as much nutrition in a sugar cookie as they can in a health food store. And because it's about the relation, the interaction, the particular moment in which the whole thing is being orchestrated. And with that, let's live more interesting lives. Let's foster our contradictions and listen to what's being called for in each situation, rather than try to put a template on every moment and say, this is how it ought to be.
Yes, I like that listening part. There's a deeper listening that really, and it's interesting because I don't know anyway whether I get quiet and listen and do end up moving in that stream of, you can call it consciousness, and I think equally you could call it correctly unconsciousness.
Right. I think it's better to call it unconscious. I don't like consciousness.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like if we think we know it and we're conscious of it, it's probably reduced nonsense.
Right. It creates a point of view, and there is no real true point of view because the view is always changing, or hopefully it is anyway.
Right. And the fun is just letting the views come forth, but then letting them go as soon as they come forth. And that's the Kalahari way. That's the improvised life.
Right. And that's why the whole interesting thing, when you start looking at the synchronicities or coincidences in your life, that immediately throws you off. It's like, notice them, but don't get hung up in them. Don't let them create the way you are the next time, or the way you are even in the next moment. It's more something to notice. And then once we notice, we're able to get deeper and notice more and more and more.
Right. I mean, we're stuck because we're never going to be able to be free of it. It's always going to seduce us to engage our mindfulness towards whatever passes by.
Right. And that seduction turns into a feeling or a desire for power, which distorts the track to God.
Right. Right. And of course, here again, teasing comes in because we think we need to pay attention or not pay attention, or to notice or not notice, or to attach ourselves to it. The other thing we can do is play with it. So we can play with whatever comes by. And in the teasing is the least attachment. Because in the teasing is the possibility for changing the whole rules, causality, relationship, including what is meant by paying attention. So if we tease and play with everything, we have more and more opportunities to express creative freedom in our being in the world. And this, I think, is the big gift. Nobody takes seriously the importance of truly being mad as a hatter, truly learning how to turn our crazy way of owning language, by that, owning the feeling for language, and using it to tease and play with whatever floats in front of us.
Right. Speaking of floating, I was driving down the highway in San Diego, and there's a big sign on the highway that says, cruise ships use airport exit. So I just imagined all these cruise ships on the highway looking for their exit. And ever since that moment, if I read a newspaper or something, if there's a word that, depending on the spelling, will mean one thing or another, my mind automatically goes to the one that just makes it absurd.
That's great.
So much fun.
That's exactly what we're talking about.
I liked earlier when you were speaking about the ancestors, and I'm wondering if you would share how the Kalahari really keep their ancestors alive. And I know with their hunting, for instance, you mention in your book how they incorporate or bring in their ancestors.
Yeah, it's always tricky to talk about those things because it's always about the relationship to one's ancestors. And this is the important thing. When we talk about ancestors or spirits or gods or these sorts of things, it's always about the relations to these really unspecifiable things. And so it becomes experienced, for example, for a hunter, in the middle of the night, they might feel a tapping on their arm. And they know that that tapping means that it's time to go hunt. And if it's a tapping on the right arm, it means that it'll be a female animal waiting for them. On the left arm, be a male animal. And if it's high in the arm, it'll be a day away. If it's near the elbow, it'll be more like 3 days. So they're so connected to their ecology that the relationship to animals is able to come forth an experience, a kinesthetic experience on their body, which they believe is mediated by the ancestors pulling on a rope that connects them, their body, to the body of the animal. Of course, that rope is a metaphor, if you wish, for relationship, but it's more than just a metaphor. You know, it's actually felt, it's somatically realized. And ancestors are not literally, you know, a ghost sitting in the room pulling on a ghost string. The ancestors are a felt, realized relationship. So they never get over the ones, the people they loved. They stay in relationship with them. They feed that relationship through song, through laughter, through tears. They don't go through the stages of grief like we do, hoping someday it goes away. They just keep the longing alive. And feeding the longing and feeding the relationship enables them to feel relationship more with everything that's alive, including the animals. So they will tell you that they find the animal in the hunt by just feeling the way the rope pulls them to the creature.
So, with what you're saying, with if you know, a relative or one in the tribe passes away, do they have, they just do their dance, but they do that anyway? Is that what you're saying? And or do people cry and cry and cry and then cry themselves out of tears, or what is generally the situation look like, or is there no one scenario?
Yeah, that's not so much that there's no map for how it should be done. You know, when we have grief, you can go buy a book and they'll tell you here's the stages you need to go through, and you can go to a counselor and they'll say, well, help you walk through these stages, and you'll go from anger to, you know, sadness to into all these various stages to finally you sort of resolve it. For them, they just allow the changing emotions associated with it to take place naturally, knowing that when they're sad, they're sad. They long, they miss, they cry, they weep. Others see the crying and they say, let's dance, because in the dance we transform whatever suffering we have and move ourselves into ecstatic joy. And it's not to say then the next day they're not sad. They might be sad again, but it's always changing. Like the weather, all our emotions are constantly changing. We don't try to fix it to be not one thing and be another thing. It's we utilize, draw upon whatever arises. So if someone's suffering, they don't have a scientist who say, I'll invent the pill that will delete suffering from human experience the way our fantasies try to create. or nor will we have willful intentionality and all kinds of magical thinking to think if we just think the right positive thoughts, it'll track the kind of healthy, you know, joyous state. They would see all that as insane. They would just say, well, this is how I'm feeling now, and I'm going to utilize it. So if you're feeling sad in the Mississippi Delta, and your ancestors were really straight from Africa, you'd start singing the blues. And this is a wellspring for expressing a music that takes that. And in the singing of the blues, you get sort of a nice feeling. And then the blues, of course, can turn into something that gets a little happier, and before you know it, you're on a train bound for glory. All you did was get on the rhythm and allow it to take you somewhere.
Right. People get ready.
That's right.
More next week with Bradford Keeney. His book, The Bushman Way of Tracking God, and next week we'll talk a bit about his book, The Flying Drum. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for iTunes podcasting, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.